This is Ron Oral, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I'm super excited today to be speaking with Patrick Gadsden, co-head of Vincent & Elkins Shareholder Activism Practice, which focuses on 24/7 activism defense work. Gadsden has advised companies against a who's who of top activist funds, including Starboard Value, Legion Partners, D.E. Shaw, Engage Capital, and Carl Icahn. Before joining V&E in 2019, Gadsden was on the other side and advised activists, and from what I remember, very high-profile activists as well, for 2 years at the top activist advisory firm, Olshan from Woloski. So unlike many activism defense advisors or activism advisors, he's worked on both sides, so he can view it from all angles. Thanks, Patrick, for taking the time.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so it's the dog days of summer, but just around the corner is another election, and we have a lot of drama there. And I have some data from an investment bank, Harris Williams, that looked at the period 1992 to 2022, excluding the 2008, which, you know, the global financial crisis, not a good year to look at M&A data. And overall, the data found that the number of U.S. transactions over that period dropped in the quarter leading up to a federal election year. So once every 4 years in the quarter leading up to the election. And then after the election was decided, keyword decided, it spiked after that. So Patrick, curious if you have some thoughts. You know, so I feel like there's a kind of a tangential impact on activism and activism M&A related to the broader M&A market and the election cycle. So I thought, Patrick, maybe you could talk about how activists might view the election and how it could impact their decision to launch an M&A-focused campaign or not?
Yes. Yeah, so first, you need M&A for M&A activism, right? You're not going to have any activism activity for no deals taking place. But do you remember the bygone era when common wisdom was that presidential elections have more effect on deal timing than deal outcomes? That era may have returned. Who knows? But a lot of that has to do with how different each respective political party is from the other and how they're far more diametrically opposed to each other on issues than they used to be. I mean, HW and Clinton's platforms were far closer than what we currently see. And so obviously that's going to have some real consequences when you think about regulatory actions of different sort of respective presidents. And the thinking is that if we happen to have Trump, the broad thinking among other advisors that I've spoken to, is that you would probably see a rolling back of a lot of Biden's executive orders, guidelines, and sort of more novel approaches to antitrust enforcement, particularly against multi-platform big tech companies. And so if you remove that wet blanket that's sort of sat on top of the M&A market at large, the thinking is you will unlock a lot of M&A activity that may have been hesitant to actually occur because of sort of the thinking that in the past, we had a situation where members of the board and members of management, they would potentially think of a potential transaction, troubleshoot it, you know, run with the bankers, figure out whether or not it would maximize shareholder value, and then contact the legal side, right? And ask, okay, is there any regulatory hair on this? I think that we've sort of been living through an administration where the tail is more wagging the dog, where now it's, okay, let's go to lawyers first, right? And let's see if we can get this through regulatory scrutiny. And then we'll troubleshoot a lot of the other economics and run that stuff down. So if you just think about just antitrust enforcement alone, that's before you even get to sort of, you know, CFIUS and sort of a more global effect on M&A in the States. There is the thinking that there will be more deals, more deal activity if Trump happens to be elected, and that would create the potential for having more M&A activism. Who knows? We actually don't have a real clear picture right now as to who will win. We just had the incumbent basically gracefully bow out, which was pretty earth-shattering news. So this may just be heuristics, right? And people just thinking, well, you know, generally speaking, you know, Democrats are this way and Republicans are that way. But I do think that eventually this stuff will all work itself out and we'll have more color as to how sort of each respective party's regulatory regimes will impact activism.
Yeah, no, that's definitely interesting. And I, from what the advisors that I spoke with for a feature I put together on the election and activism, you all agreed that this is kind of an election cycle where the different administration will have a major impact on antitrust, and you'll see a lot of different kinds of M&A in different sectors targeted. But they did also, I know you were talking about it as a bygone era, but it is, and it still is a factor from the data I got, I've been getting, you know, in the near term, that M&A is slowed down. And just anecdotally, currently, I feel like in the period leading up to this election, you know, the 2-3 months leading up to the election, just not a lot of M&A activism. And all the major activist campaigns that I've been looking at, I've seen from activists like Elliott Management, which often do M&A, you know, approaches to their activism, I'm seeing very operational type activism. Are you seeing in the period leading up to the election more operationally focused activism, or are you still seeing some M&A focused activism?
Yeah. And so over the last maybe few years, we have seen this trending towards more operations based activism. Mm-hmm. I think part of that isn't necessarily a reflection of a Biden administration, but more of a reflection of monetary policy, where we had pretty significant interest rate creep. And so obviously, if we're in a higher interest rate environment, that's going to flow through deal activity because somebody has to finance these things, right? You have to pay for the actual acquisition. So I think that's probably more of a variable in the calculus.
Right.
But when it comes to any political consequences for when operationally based campaigns, usually what we've seen historically is that almost all operations based campaigns by activists are really targeting operating margins, SG&A cuts, right? Mm-hmm. You aren't really going to see that many activists be able to pound their chests and say they are really informed on how to grow gross margins, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of reasons for that. Gross margins are statistically sticky. After a company sort of reached minimum efficient scale, it's very, very difficult to, you know, radically change those gross margins. I know you know there's been a lot of talk about quality earnings over the last maybe 3 or 4 years. And much of sort of that quality, if it is sort of baked into gross margins, is just pricing power, which has absolutely nothing to do with an activist. That's something that's sort of a systemic part of your business. Either you have it or you don't. So when you think about, you know, the targets of the activist campaigns in terms of operations and the SG&A cuts, that has some political sensitivities because you're talking about potentially laying off people, right? Uh-huh. Laying off a lot of people. And so obviously it's more difficult to lay off people or to otherwise terminate people, especially when you're dealing with a big bucket of employees for more heavy asset based companies, if you are in a very highly regulated industry, right? Mm-hmm. Highly regulated industries tend to have more collective bargaining agreements involved. They tend to be more politically sensitive because unions are inherently sort of also political organizations. And the tension between management and labor, I think domestically, has always been sort of political in some respects. Mm-hmm. And so if you are an activist and you're thinking about targeting an industry and you don't know what's going to happen in November, right? Mm-hmm. But you're thinking, I would really like to see random Acme Co. company that's in a heavy asset industry lay off a lot of people or make all these cuts to SG&A that otherwise, you know, would have second and third order consequences on a decrease in labor headcount. But I know that if there is for example, a Trump administration, maybe there'd be a much lighter touch from a regulatory perspective. And maybe there wouldn't be this thought that, oh, if you, for example, lay off all these people in transportation or logistics, it's going to have safety consequences because you aren't going to be able to have watchmen for the watchmen. So if you have a maybe more friendly administration from that perspective, you may be able to sort of force more changes on a company by advocating for your for your reduction in headcount thesis than you would in a political regime that was far more muscular when it comes to regulatory oversight, right? So there are consequences around sort of how activists, at least in my opinion, think to engage with companies about operations-based campaigns. But I don't think all of those consequences are necessarily coming out of whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration so much as what's the macro here, guys? Because I think a lot of this does have a great deal to do with interest rates. And what is interesting, I think, about each respective political party is that even if you do think about sort of the more monetary-based consequences on M&A activity and activism, I do think that each respective candidate, whether it be Harris, if she happens to be, you know, more in lockstep with Biden, if she actually were in the big seat, or whether it be Trump based on his sort of previous presidential tenure and how his administration sort of viewed monetary policy. The Biden administration has been far more tight-lipped about whether they're critical of Fed Chair Powell or they're critical of the Fed's sort of general signaling of monetary policy than we've seen from Trump.
Right? That's for sure.
Trump's probably the most direct and vocal president about Fed policy and actions of a Fed chair since Nixon and Burns, Arthur Burns. So there is some logic and some thinking behind, okay, well, if you did get a Trump administration, you're going to have this president that would be far more vocal about wanting to see a more loose monetary policy. Yes, the Fed says that it's sort of views itself as insulated from political winds, but how insulated? And is there any sort of unconscious thinking that could possibly go on within the Fed that would be a result of maybe political pressures from a president who has absolutely no issue with being hypercritical or sort of otherwise trying to pressure the Federal Reserve into doing exactly what he would like to see with respect to monetary policy? So I think that there's also that sort of aspect of how the election could change activism and M&A. But I think that also is sort of a wait and see thing as well, as all these things are.
And I had actually already forgotten about the former President Trump's kind of agitations towards the Fed historically. Yeah, I never thought about that. So it's very interesting. So Patrick, it sounds like what you're saying is that both operational activism and M&A activism may be waiting for some clarity about who will be the next president. And because there's so many different kind of political factors, you know, in addition to all the macroeconomic factors like interest rates, but there's that kind of political factors into whether you would launch an operational campaign in addition to an M&A campaign. But let's flash forward. Let's say we have a Trump administration.
Okay.
And I'm curious, you know, then maybe we see a lot of lifting up of the antitrust restrictions on a number of sectors. I know that there's these kind of one-off situations where Trump got personally involved in antitrust issues. So not completely clear how they would be, but, you know, some more laissez-faire antitrust administration. Mm-hmm. Are there particular sectors you think an activist might decide to target in like a Trump administration? And then maybe, you know, other ones that you would see targeted in a Kamala Harris administration?
Yeah. So I think that contextually, taking a step back, this for me would also be based on a lot of monetary consequences and signaling that we've seen from Powell, whether it be his comments at the DC Economic Club, I think last week or the week before, and assuming Trump were to be a very vocal president when it comes to how he views the job that the Fed and the Fed chair are doing. I'm thinking, assuming a less tight policy, the more interest rate sensitive type of industries, you might see a lot more activism, right? So your logistics type heavy asset, we need to finance our CapEx, your financials, your real estate, your utilities. I'm thinking those are the sorts of industries that I could potentially see activists maybe diving into, assuming we have sort of looser monetary policy due to the coupling of a Trump presidency and his potential to publicly agitate and maybe have some consequences on whether or not the Fed actually did what many believe it's signaling, which is lower interest rates. So I'm thinking those may be some of the industries where you'd see it. But at the same time, right? I mean, interest rates, that's really just cost of capital, right? So it does have this lens through which you have to look at it, which is it's going to affect every company, every business, and particularly the growthy companies where a lot of the value is predicted to be in the terminal value of the companies. So I could see it happening or having consequences across all industries, but assuming that there is this sort of decrease in interest rate policy, certainly could see the more interest rate sensitive industries like real estate and utilities and financials have an uptick in activity for sure.
And what about ESG? You know, environmental, social, and governance issues. I remember there was a period around 2021 where they factored heavily into a lot of traditional activist hedge fund campaigns. And I'm wondering whether we'll see kind of ESG factor into campaigns in in one administration or another administration. And we've all seen a growth of anti-ESG proposal activism. I'm wondering.
I don't know if you're allowed to say ESG anymore. I don't know if you're allowed to say it. So we have seen the politicization of ESG and DEI, we'll call it, like a subcategory of ESG. And we've seen that over the last sort of few years. I think we've also seen economic activists, right? Not your ESG themed activists, because I view them as sort of separate players, although they play in a similar sandbox. I kind of bucket them differently. Your economic players not lean in as much to any ESG aspects of their respective shareholder value unlock theses as we saw in the past. And I think part of that has to do with a repositioning of the large institutional shareholders that have clearly repositioned how their policies do or do not sort of advocate for ESG and DEI. And ultimately, you're trying to get votes, right? So if there's a change in policy among the vote you're trying to get, then you change your thesis, right? Mm-hmm. You change a bit. And so it's, for me, it's a sort of thing that we have to remember: corporate America, Wall Street, doesn't exist outside of society. So as there are societal changes, there will be changes within corporate America and within activism and within everything else. And ultimately, ESG has become a political football. And so now we're even seeing like different ESGs and different DEIs. An alternative to DEI, I think, is being advocated on the more right-leaning side of the fence is MIE, Merit, Intelligence, and Excellence. It's sort of like the other side of DEI, and they're pushing
that. I haven't heard that acronym. Am I going to be hearing more about that acronym?
I think you will. Elon has been a pretty vocal advocate for it, and as his Twitter feed goes, so does the political consciousness, I think, to a certain degree with respect to a more right-leaning ideology. But it certainly is the sort of thing where we aren't seeing nearly as much ESG pieces of DCs, even privately, being communicated by activists to companies as we saw in the past. And when it comes to DEI in particular, part of the DEI conversation, I think also part of the ESG conversation, is not for companies just a conversation about activism. If, for example, you are in an extraction type industry or a heavy asset type industry, in all likelihood, just thinking generally, your human capital base has a very particular view on DEI and ESG. Mm-hmm. And you have to not just think about sort of activism and how an activist will or won't push you in a more anti-DEI or anti-ESG direction, but you also have to think about, okay, internal stakeholders, if we were to make a position or take a position on DEI or ESG, how would they respond? I think that what we've seen is that many companies in more extractive industries or heavy asset industries are hesitant to even use DEI or say ESG or put it in policy, because they're not just concerned about externally their optics, but they're concerned about how their actual employee labor base will respond to it. And it's not the type of thing where there are any easy answers, but as we continue to see the more politicization of ESG and DEI, I think it's safe to assume we won't see that many either pure ESG campaigns like we saw at Starbucks, or any campaigns from economic activists where there's this huge sort of bolt-on ESG or DEI theme that they hope to resonate with the shareholder base. And that's just a reflection of adaptation of activists in the market, because we are all in the same society and you can't extract corporate America or Wall Street.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fascinating. It'll be interesting to see if your thoughts play out. I agree that I suspect we won't see that much ESG in an economic activist's playbook in the months to come, but we'll see what happens. I wanted to shift gears a little bit to some non-election related topics. And okay. I'm actually working on a feature on this topic, so I wanted to get your thoughts on it. And it relates to kind of preparation for an activist, you know, an activist situation. You have a contest coming up and you get to the stage where you have to do a presentation before Institutional Shareholder Services and Glass Lewis, presumably also, but I guess primarily to ISS. And so I wanted to talk about how to prepare for that. But also, we often see these companies do what the people in the industry describe as a defensive refresh of the board. They add a couple of directors. You know, the activist is criticizing the existing board. You think the activist is going to nominate their own candidates. The company will bring in some new improved candidates. Often activists will target companies where there are red flags with some of the existing directors. And I guess, Patrick, if you could maybe just walk me through a little bit how ISS and institutional investors really respond to these defensive refreshes. And is it a good strategy to help defend the company against an activist?
Yeah, it's a great question. So in the past, when thinking about refreshes, there was this thinking that if you did it and you were the company, that the proxy advisors are going to say, yes, you did it, but you did it so long after the activist had publicly surfaced, or you did it after the activist had publicly surfaced at all. And so we're really going to reward the activist for that refreshment. We aren't going to say to you, yeah, nice job, when in reality, from the proxy advisor's perspective, maybe the refreshment was long overdue and the agitation catalyst being the activist is what should be rewarded. That was the thinking, I'd say, 2021.
The perspective from the proxy advisors.
The proxy advisors, correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think, and since from our perspective as defense practitioners, we view that to be the proxy advisor's perspective. That was then the perspective when thinking about advising companies on whether or not to, you know, accelerate a refresh or start one, right? If they had not anticipated starting. I think around 2020 or so, we did start to see some changes in how ISS in particular was viewing refreshments. So
that they were more supportive, they were more encouraging, they gave company more credit for it.
Right. So I think a better way of phrasing it would be they didn't penalize companies for it. Mm-hmm. Right. So actions by a company can modify the tests sort of within the ISS test is change warranted. Right. So ISS has its test, is change warranted. Who's in the best position to affect that change? That's their contested situations, proxy contest sort of framework. Right. Mm-hmm. So even if on the basis of operational performance, the dissident makes a compelling case for change after 2021 or so, if the company had refreshed after the dissident had sort of formally launched a proxy fight, which ISS sort of implied was admitting by the company that some change had been warranted, there was a slight pivot by ISS to a change in the primary question, seeming to change to whether the additions to the board satisfied the board's needs, or whether further change was necessary to sort of rectify any operational damage and ensure that the company is on a more sustainable path. Mm-hmm. Right. And that is different than is change warranted. It's sort of a micro test within that test based on the company's different decision making after receiving notification that they were in a contest, right? After the, and after, particularly after the activist had surfaced publicly. So now it's like, if the board does a great deal of change after the beginning of an activist campaign, then seemingly you're going to get an implied test from ISS in particular. Was there a compelling case for change when the activist launched the campaign? Well, yeah, probably, because you did stuff. You refreshed. So you're trying to say there wasn't, but yeah, you did stuff. So you kind of know that you're acknowledging that change is warranted, but you are relying on sort of that sub micro test of, do the recent developments of your refreshment fully address the concerns the activist brought, or is there further board change that's actually necessary?
So now, okay, so you've made that, you added some new directors that the company needs, kind of the company finds them. This is not a settlement with the activist. And you have to do a presentation before ISS. And I'm really kind of curious, because I've never been in the room for one of these presentations. I don't even know, are they virtual meetings? Are they in person? You go to Rockville to do these presentations to ISS? I know that both sides present big decks and they release them publicly. And I see the decks that you present to ISS. But you know, for example, let's say you bring in a new director. Do you bring that director to ISS? Do you prepare in advance to make sure that they don't say something stupid to ISS? Maybe they're not prepared for what the kind of things that ISS is looking for.
Yes. So the last thing you want to do as an advisor is to send in directors and or the CEO to speak with ISS or Glass Lewis with no preparation. Like, that's probably not the best way to spend your time getting ready for your annual meeting if you're in a contest. That's the first thing. So a great deal of time is spent in preparation. And part of that isn't just because you want to make the best impression on ISS and Glass Lewis as you can. It's because there is an acknowledgement that if you're dealing with, call a very experienced activist, you're dealing with a party that has had many bites at the apple in terms of engaging with ISS in proxy contests and learning how to refine how they articulate their theses and why they think they should win. And now you're dealing with a client who maybe has never spoken to. So as opposed to, you know, trying to stack the deck through preparation, it's more of a rebalancing of experience sets with, you know, the activists having, especially an experienced activist, having maybe dozens of different ISS meetings where they're pitching their theses and why they should win, versus a company, on the other hand, with directors and maybe a C-suite executive who never even been through the gauntlet, right? So a lot of preparation there, particularly with the directors who were targeted by the activists and the CEO and the chair, if either of them were targeted as well. You spend, I'd say, the 2 weeks leading to the meeting, there probably are multiple hypothetical conversations and sort of boot camp stress test sessions where maybe you have an advisor who plays the part of ISS and you go through it, right? Wow. And you troubleshoot, you know, different aspects of how the directors or the CEO articulates him or herself, and whether or not they're doing so in a way that they think that they're doing. So what we found is that they'll say something and then you'll follow up with them and say, well, did you mean this? And then, well, no, I didn't mean that. What I meant was, right? And so it's getting them to say exactly what they mean the first time, because there's no saying that you're actually going to have a member of ISS say, well, what did you mean? Did you mean this? And you may never be able to sort of unring the bell.
Right.
So there is a lot of time put into this. There's, you know, talking points prepared and, you know, different scenarios that are, you know, run through. And it's a very informative thing, I think, for most board members who participate in it. From their perspective, they're doing great things or things that are not bad at a minimum, and they're working really hard. And how could people not see their efforts? How could people not understand? And so when you walk them through that scenario, it kind of knocks the scales from the eyes and lets them know, oh, it's not just the activist who may be skeptical. Maybe we aren't hearing the full unvarnished truth when we speak to our institutional shareholders. Maybe they would be more like the scenario we're running through with ISS, right? And so as opposed to, you know, focusing on what the activist may think, it's more of a focus on, here's maybe a demonstration of what your institutional shareholders may think. And it's going to be more telegraphed through the ISS meeting and your prep for that meeting, because it's probably a better reflection of what an independent third party would think of the circumstances than you may be getting from institutional shareholders who also, while they're interacting with you and they're constructively engaging with you, maybe don't want to be seen as antagonistic or don't want to seem like they're against you in any way.
Okay. Wow. Well, sounds like a lot of preparation before you go meet the ISS, because I know that those proxy advisor recommendations can be make or break for an activist or company side of the proxy fight. So we are out of time, and you've been listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast, and we've been speaking to Patrick Gadson, co-head of Vincent and Elkins Shareholder Activism Practice. Thanks, Patrick, for taking the time.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.